A wind from the west at 16, gusting to 25, 26 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about an educational and entertaining podcast designed primarily for young people that celebrates the beauty of folktales from all around the world. The podcast has now gotten into the book publishing business. In part two, we'll be talking about how all of us can become better peacemakers. Here's part one. Well, public radio listeners are certainly likely to know the name of Rebecca Scheer. And we're going to be talking about two things with which Rebecca Scheer has been busy as of late. First of all, over the last several years, she has been involved, in fact, the driving creative force behind a marvelous podcast out of WBUR in Boston called Circle Round, an extraordinary podcast, primarily, I think, with children in mind, but listeners of all ages have enjoyed folk tales and stories from all around the world, told in incredibly vivid fashion by a wonderful host of various different actors who are on the scene. And now Circle Round is also expanding to include beautiful, colorful books to tell some of these stories in that way. And Rebecca Scheer is with us to talk about all of this and more. Rebecca Scheer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad we can have this conversation. Let's find out first from you where this love of stories began. I mean, do we trace this back to very early in your life, or is this something that has become an important part of your life a little later?
I think it began way back at the beginning. When I was in kindergarten, I had already started reading and writing. And during nap time, my teacher recognized that I was able to read and write, and she didn't make me sleep. All the other kids had to roll up with their sleeping bags and towels and blankets, and she let me write stories. She would pull out this big lined paper with a big empty space at the top to draw a picture. And I would write these, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 sentence stories and then illustrate them. And that love of storytelling has been with me ever since.
So tell us ahead of the Circle Round podcast and some of your work with public radio, how you acted on that love of storytelling before these latest exploits.
Well, writing was always important to me all through school. I did creative writing contests and things like that. I was a film major, interestingly, at Columbia University in New York, but that's very much a storytelling-based, you know, discipline. Then I got my MFA in creative writing from the University of Iowa, and that was where I stumbled into public radio. I met the folks at Iowa Public Radio, we hit it off, and they gave me my own show. And from there, I went to Alaska Public Radio, I had my own show. Then I was in Washington, D.C., where I had my own show again. And now my husband and I have joined forces, we have a son, and I've decided to give reporting a little break for now and pivot into the world of children's storytelling. But like you said, our listeners aren't just kids. Entire families around the world are listening, and that's a great thing to hear.
So one of the things that is obviously very important to you are those two words, Circle Round. I mean, not only is that the title of your podcast, but it is also a pair of words that we hear you use again and again as we listen to you hosting the program and even as you talk about it. Tell us what is behind these two simple words and why they mean so much to you.
when you hear the words circle round, for me, I picture people sitting around a circle communing and communicating. You think about folktales. They're these traditional stories or legends originating among a people or a folk. And they've been around for all these generations, and they probably originated with folks sitting around the fire, trying to pass the time and entertain each other and bond through telling stories. So even though our listeners are in over 160 countries around the world, we try to give the podcast a warm, intimate feel as if I am sitting in a big circle with all these children and sharing these amazing tales.
It is something that involves you as host, writer, producer, but you also bring in some luminaries to be part of this, and a lot of familiar names like Jay Farrow and Leah Salonga and Joshua Malina and many, many others that I could name. What's that like to bring in folks like that to be part of Circle Round?
Oh, the casting is one of the most fun parts of the podcast. When I was a film major back in college, I sort of dreamed of being a casting director. It was a dream I had for about 5 minutes. I eventually put it to bed. But now all these years later, I get to be a casting director. I get to research these stories, write these stories, and start to hear the voices in my head. And I think, who is this person? That's Leah Salonga. I'm going to reach out to Leah Salonga's people, her agents, her managers, publicists, and see if she's interested. Likewise, Ed Asner, the dearly departed Ed Asner from Mary Tyler Moore Show and Elf and Up. I wrote this story about this old man celebrating his 100th birthday. And as I wrote, I just heard Ed Asner's voice in my head. And I thought, he'll probably say no, but I'm going to email him. And next thing I know, I'm recording with Ed Asner. So that's like a huge bonus with the podcast, I have to say.
One thing that is evident, I mean, and I don't think you're particularly coy about this. I mean, you're very open about the fact that these stories undergo some degree of adaption, particularly in part because in many cases these folk tales come from various places and do not come down to us in a single fixed form. Tell us about what is most important to you as you decide in what form a particular folktale will be shared with the public on your podcast, Circle Round.
Well, what's really important to me is respecting the source material, keeping the integrity of the story, but also making it accessible and exciting for modern audiences. You know, like I said, these folktales go back generations and generations and generations to times, for instance, where there wasn't a lot of equity among sexes, among the genders. So many of the heroes in these folktales are just that, heroes. They're males coming in to save the day. So many of the monarchs are kings, not queens. So one thing that we definitely do is try to make things more equitable so that little girls listening can see themselves in these stories as well. So that involves a little bit of modernizing. One folktale we found from Romania, Stan and the Dragon, who fights the dragon so that he can support his family. We changed it to Stella and the Dragon. And to this day, that it was our second episode ever. It's one of our most popular episodes ever, too.
One thing that you have decided to do is to take this wonderful experience of sharing stories and stepping into the world of book publishing with I think three Circle Round books, the most recent called The Great Ball Game, which is delightful, and I believe a fourth book along the way. Tell us about that decision and what prompted it.
Well, obviously we wrote the podcast. When we write the podcast, it's for the ear. But we thought, wouldn't it be really, really cool to turn Circle Round into an experience for the eye? And the ear, of course, too, since we're hoping kids and their grown-ups will be reading this book out loud. But we thought it would be really exciting to have Circle Round come to life in a pictorial form. And something else that can happen when you do that is you are reaching a new audience. There may be families out there who can't experience Circle Round because perhaps the children don't process information as successfully through their ears. Perhaps they're more of a visual learner. Perhaps they're deaf or hard of hearing. Perhaps they don't have time to listen to a 25-minute episode podcast. Well, with the book, you can bring it with you, you can take it out, you can take your time, you can take as much time as you want on each page, especially if the children are doing the reading out loud. It's great for them to practice their reading. And we get to work with these illustrators from all over the world. The illustrator for our current book, The Great Ball Game, is an Ojibwe woodland artist named Joshua Powis Steckley. And when I wrote the episode, The Great Ball Game, on the podcast, I could not have imagined the gorgeous, vibrant pictures he would have created to accompany this tale.
And we should clarify that it's not just you have illustrators from all over the world, but they are carefully chosen as coming from the country or the region where that folktale is thought to originate. So if you are telling a story that is a folktale from China, you are wanting an illustrator from China to be part of the experience of creating that book, correct?
Absolutely. It was really important to us that the illustrators were steeped in the culture or the country or the region where the story came from. Chaya Prabhat, for instance, who lives in India, she illustrated her book A Taste of Honey, which is adapted from a tale from Pakistan and India. And her pictures just jump off the page. You are sucked into this world of this woman as she's going about her adventure of fooling these thieves so that she can support herself and her ailing father. Likewise with the tale of the unwelcome guest. There are many versions of the folktale that that's based on, but we were mostly influenced by the one from Turkey. And Mert Tugin, our illustrator, lives in Istanbul, and he put such a special, gorgeous, authentic touch on every illustration.
So tell us about this book that has just come out called The Great Ball Game. I have seen it, and I absolutely love this story. For the sake of our listeners who have not yet seen this or are not acquainted with the story, explain The Great Ball Game.
Absolutely. It's adapted from our podcast episode of the same name. And when researching source material for that episode, we found versions of this story from the Cherokee people, Creek, Ojibwe, and Menominee, all those peoples of North America. So in our version, the animals and birds are fighting about which side is better. This takes place way, way back when the world is young, before humans roamed the earth and the animals could talk. They're fighting and fighting and fighting, and they challenge each other to a great ball game to decide once and for all who's the best, the animals or the birds. And then this unexpected critter shows up who doesn't seem to belong on either team. His name is Bat. And the animals say, well, you can't join our team, Bat, because look at you, you have wings. And the birds say, well, you can't join our team because you have, you know, fur. So not to spoil the ending, but let's just say that adventures ensue, and there are some really important lessons imparted about the importance of diversity and nonconformity and embracing a world where everyone is different.
So we have three books in hand and a fourth that is on the way. How tricky was it to make the transformation from stories that are being told and listened to stories that are on the page? I mean, were there any unanticipated challenges in that process of shifting to a different sort of media?
That's a great question. When we're writing the podcast, we're trying to create a movie for your mind. We often refer to Circle Round as a movie for our listeners' minds. So every now and again, you'll have me say that a character shrugged, or a character smiled, or a character leaned back and crossed their arms. I found that when writing with an illustrator, I don't need to include statements like that. You know, Chaya can have our character smiling, or Mert can have our character waving his arms in the air. So I realized not as much of the onus was on me. I could partner up with these illustrators so that together the words and the pictures had a really great synergetic quality. Other things that we thought about was, you know, we're making it as read out loudable as possible. So I've never thought about things like the layout of a page, the color of a font. If a grown-up is reading this book with a child at bedtime and it's kind of dim in the room, you want to keep that in mind in terms of what the font looks like, where the picture is. And as someone who's been in radio for so long, granted I was a film major, but that was a while ago, I've just been so into writing for the ear that this really opened my eyes to the ways you have to write for the eye.
Fascinating. You mentioned that you and your husband have a son. I don't know what age he is, but is he somebody that you think about a lot as you shape these stories and try to figure out what is going to be most captivating for a young listener or young reader?
Indeed. Our son is our apprentice, our intern, our test audience. He's 6.5 years old. And as I'm writing a script, sometimes I'll read a section aloud to him and say, does this make sense? Do you understand what's happening with this character? Or which word should I use? Should I say glittering or shimmering? And he's listened to all 185 episodes multiple times, so he definitely has an ear for it. But he's coming at it from the perspective of a six-year-old, so he's been incredibly useful. And we've also used his voice in some episodes, so he's also a budding voiceover talent.
Wow. There you go. So the podcast Circle Round is widely available and very much worth exploring. And now the Circle Round podcast is also producing wonderful books, beautifully illustrated children's books, the most recent titled The Great Ball Game. And at the helm of all of these projects, Rebecca Shear. Rebecca Shear, thank you so much for giving the world all of these wonderful stories and best wishes as you go forward.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I think just about all of us will agree that the world needs to be a more peaceful place, and certainly we can look around us and see all kinds of evidence that that in fact we are not at peace, and not just in places where there is open warfare, but even within our own individual lives and in our communities, there is a need for peace, for a more harmonious coexistence and a spirit of cooperation and compassion with one another. One of the most interesting books I have seen on this topic is a book just published called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. The author of the book is Eric David Dawson, who is the CEO of an organization called Peace First, which he helped to create right around the time that he graduated from high school. As a very young person, Eric David Dawson was interested in trying to be a peacemaker in his own community. And he has taken that cause to higher and higher levels. And in fact, Peace First works not only here but abroad as well to try to galvanize young people in particular to be peacemakers. And we're going to be exploring some of what he talks about in this book, which is published by Viking. Again, it's called Putting Peace First. Eric David Dawson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You open the book with something very interesting in the prologue, in which you talk about how you as a young person would have been somebody that we would not have maybe immediately thought of as a peacemaker in the making. The first sentence of the book is, I was a pretty angry kid. You mean that in a particular way. Describe to our listeners the way in which you were actually a very angry kid.
So, I don't think I'm unusual in this, in that as a young person, I picked up on a lot of the adult hypocrisy around me, where adults would talk about one thing being important and then model something different. I was frustrated by the injustices that I saw around me and my lack of perceived power to make a difference. And the reason I wanted to start with that invitation is because there are young people all over our country who are angry. And what we tend to do is dismiss anger as a bad thing. And what I wanted to invite young people to do is to think about their own anger, their own frustration, not as negative, but as an opportunity to leverage those emotions to try to heal a very broken world.
Mm. So explain how you first, in a sense, became a peacemaker in your own community, in your own backyard. What were some of the first efforts which you personally undertook?
So I went to a very large public high school in the Midwest, and this was the start of the inclusion movement, which meant that young people with disabilities who'd been kept in substantially separate learning environments for most of their education were being mainstream, joining the regular ed population for health class and lunchtime and gym class, and basically got the crap beat out of them, either physically or emotionally. And so as a 14-year-old with a group of other young people, that really connected to my sense of justice. And so I began organizing at my school to change the way that students treated one another. So rather than the principal saying, where is there a tolerance school, we don't do that, it was student to student saying, this is not who we are. And it worked. It changed the culture of our school, made it a more accepting, tolerant, welcoming place. And of course, it didn't feel like enough. So with my fellow students, began creating a district-wide training program for every fourth, fifth, and sixth grader around inclusion of people with disabilities. And so for me, it was the first time I got to feel powerful in a way that it wasn't about hurting someone else, but creating new opportunities.
Mm. In the book's introduction that follows the prologue, you talk about a big lie that young people are told again and again. And it is a lie that is delivered with the best of intentions, but nevertheless, in your mind, is a counterproductive lie. I want to read the first paragraph and then have you take it from there. This is the book's introduction. You are the future. The scene could be from any assembly at any school anywhere in the world. An inspirational speaker sweating in the bright lights of the auditorium, explaining how important you will be someday. It seems from the moment you are born, adults are talking about your bright future, how with hard work, focus, and determination, you will be a great writer, athlete, leader, teacher, artist, whatever, someday. How at some distant point in the future, you will change the world. This is a lie. Explain how this is a lie.
So I'm smiling. I was invited to be a graduation speaker at an elementary school, and I opened it up with, the students are sitting in front of me, all the faculty and parents, and I said, your teachers and parents have been lying to you. That didn't go over quite as well as I'd hoped. But we do that, right? Our narratives about young people is they are our victims that we need to protect or potential victims. They're perpetrators that we need to punish. So we incarcerate young people. We medicate young people. We turn our schools into prisons, literally, with metal detectors, police officers, or we locate their power in the future, right? We go in and we tell young people they're going to be great artists, leaders, writers, activists, thinkers someday in the distant future. And the intention is good, right? The intention is to locate our hopes and our dreams and visions for young people and who they can be. But the practice is so disempowering, right? The message is so disempowering because what we're telling young people is you have to wait, that you can't do these things now. And in fact, if you look at the research, young people are some of our most powerful innovators because of their proximity to the problem, and also because they're not fettered in the ways of thinking. They're not sort of trapped in the systems that say, well, we just can't do that.
Hmm. And it's so interesting to think about how when we deliver that message that, in a sense, might inadvertently disconnect young people from getting into the thick of the work of peacemaking, we're in a sense robbing the cause of some of the people that might be the most effective.
That's right. And our country is full of that in our history, whether it's Native Americans, African Americans, and the lack of citizenship, women unable to vote, and so I think our complicated arc of justice is trying to draw the circle of citizenship, and then I use that term broadly, sort of feeling like you're both an owner and a contributor and have power within the system, of trying to draw that circle bigger and bigger. And I think young people need to be included in that circle. Mm.
In this same chapter, this same introduction, you make a really important point, I think, that's worth exploring when you say, peace can be a difficult idea to wrap your hands around. It can seem passive, being weak and letting others take advantage of you. It can feel soft and fuzzy, sitting in a quiet meadow, holding hands and singing songs. It is often defined by what it is not, no conflicts and fewer weapons. And it can seem unattainable, needing to measure up to iconic leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, and Mother Teresa. But peace can also be strong and active. It can be daring and bold, and it is something you can do every day. So what is the way in which you are thinking about peace and peacemaking within the context of this book? Because that word can mean very different things to different people, as you've just alluded to in this paragraph.
It's such a great question. And, you know, language matters, right? The language that we use. And, you know, I come out of the violence prevention field where I work and got my start really helping to prevent violence. And what I realized is that so much of that language was negative. It was about stopping young people from doing things. It was looking at young people as diseased. And so what I wanted to do through this reclaiming of the word peace is to take something that everyone agrees is a good thing, right? There's not really an anti-peace crowd out there, right? The sense that, oh, yeah, peace is great. Like, we want peace. But it's almost lost its meaning. And so we wanted to take this word that's global and big and create something that was meaningful and muscular for young people. It's something they could have as an identity. Like, I'm a peacemaker. Like, that's what I do. That's who I am. And so for us, peacemaking is grounded in three big ideas. One is compassion, the ability to cross lines of difference, to see other people's needs as your own. And so I write about this commitment to opening your heart. Courage, the ability to take a risk, to stand up for yourself, for someone else, for an idea. And then collaborative leadership. So wanting to move away from the narratives of single individuals driving change and reflecting how change happens, which is, you know, networks of people getting together to make the world a better place. So we wanted to, in this book, create language that soared, that invited young people to be part of something big, but then also made it very specific, right? Peacemaking is when you offer your seat to someone. You know, peacemaking is learning someone else's point of view. Peacemaking is the art of putting into practice this commitment to take risks and work with others. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eric David Dawson. He is the CEO and co-founder of the group Peace First and the author of a brand new book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. In some respects, the heart and soul of your book involves those seven commitments, which you call your Peacemaker Manifesto, a set of commitments to guide you on your journey. Tell our listeners about the Peacemaker Manifesto.
You know, as I was putting this book together, what I realized is we spend so much time asking young people what they want to do when they grow up, right? That's our message. Like, what do you want to do? But we don't spend enough time asking young people who they want to be right now. And so the idea of writing this as a manifesto, and I co-created and I wrote this with a group of young people, so their language, their ideas infused the creation of it, is I wanted to give a set of principles by which young people can structure their lives. So rather than saying in situation A, this is what you should do, situation B, this is what you should do, ground young people in a set of beliefs and practices about what it means to move through the world with a peacemaking lens. And I love the idea of a manifesto, right? This thing that you sign on to that represents how you see the world and how you see yourself in the world. Hmm.
I want you to talk for a moment about one of these specific commitments, and I think it's very interesting within the context of the others. Put piece first every day, raise my hand, I mean, get in there, open my heart, take a stand, bring others along, keep trying, all very, very obvious and clearly true. The one that probably is a little bit tricky for some people is commitment six, or maybe the trickiest, I should say, of the seven, work with my enemies. I will cross lines of difference to get things done. I will not let history, fear, or mistrust keep me from connecting with people who can help. I can find common cause on a few things without needing to agree on everything. Of all of these seven commitments, this is probably the one that is the most timely and probably in some respects the most intimidating, just given the culture in which we're living right now. Describe more about what you're thinking of here and maybe how this has been true for you and how it can be true for all of us when we learn to somehow work with our enemies.
I love that you center on that one. One, because it was the language that I put in there, I got a lot of pushback on, that seemed negative, that the sense that we've got enemies is not the way to locate this. And I did because I wanted to play with that language, because we do define people as our enemies, whether that kid in school who's unkind to us or the political party that's against things that we believe in. And when you define someone as your enemy, it gives this sense of they're excluded from our circle of concern, right? We draw our circles of concern smaller and smaller. You know, it originally was called work with unlikely allies. And I really wanted to lift up this language because it felt so important right now. You know, and the story I tell as part of this work is Babatunde, a young man from Baltimore who walking home from school, was stopped by the police on suspicion of something or other, and handcuffed, thrown to the ground, and threatened, and then released. And not an unusual experience for a young man of color in Baltimore. And you know, he took that experience and he interviewed other young people of color about their experiences. You know, 17 years old. But he didn't stop there. He then went and interviewed police officers and asked them about their experiences. What's it like when you walk up to a group of young people you don't know? What goes through your mind? And his insight was that police officers and young people are terrified of each other because they don't know each other. And so designed this really innovative training that brought together police officers and young people to act out different scenarios where the police officers had to be young people and vice versa. In these high-pressure, high-stakes situations to create that sense of empathy. And what for me was so moving about Babatunde's story is that he went and worked with police officers against a tremendous amount of pressure not to do that from his community, from his friends, from police officers, you know, who were very resistant to having a 17-year-old come and tell them what to do. You know, what's so powerful is what he realized is that the enemy, you know, quote unquote, has got to be part of the solution. That you can't just work on this from the perspective of young people, but you have to change the system. And you know, in writing his story, I gave all the young people who I feature in the book a chance to just review it and make sure I'd captured what was right and true. And you know, where he pushed back on the way I told the story originally was that it seemed too neat. Like it had this arc that made it sound like everything was great. He grew to love police officers. And that wasn't true to his experience. He grew to understand that they too are victims of a system that dehumanizes everybody. But that it wasn't like he went through this experience and learned to love police officers and became a police officer himself. But rather, he came to see that there's an opportunity to partner around critical issues that can help liberate everyone. And so working with your enemy is about that. It's about realizing that our liberation is bound up together. You know, we can't fix sexism without changing the way we raise our boys. We just can't. And so this message to young people is, who are people who disagree with you or might be standing in your way, and how can you enlist them in places where you have common ground?
We're speaking with Eric David Dawson about his new book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. It is, in a sense, a guidebook meant to be a galvanizing inspiration for young people to be peacemakers in their own communities, whatever that means, and around whatever issues are of a special concern for them. So we've already talked about your Peacemaker Manifesto and the seven commitments that comprise it. And then we should say that your book goes on to explore seven young people who have been peacemakers. You just told one of those stories, and each one of these seven commitments has a particular story attached to it. Tell us more about how you came to know these seven young peacemakers, and were they each peacemakers whom you have worked with through Peace First, or by other means did you come to know their own stories?
Yeah, and I should say, I would say one of the hardest parts of writing this book was choosing which stories to highlight. I could have written thousands of chapters about so many young people doing interesting, creative, dynamic work. So Peace First is a global platform for 13 to 25-year-olds who want to change the world and aren't quite sure where to start. So just as we run science fairs in communities, we run social justice fairs, if you will, digitally, helping young people identify an issue, create a solution, and then we invest in their ideas with money, mentoring, tools. And as part of this work, we have a prize, like a Nobel Peace Prize for young people to lift up and invest in young people's courageous work. And so through that, we've met, you know, thousands of young people who have done really creative, brave, compassionate peacemaking work. And so these are all young people that I met through the Peace First Prize process who are who felt like very human examples of what it takes to be a peacemaker. And so in crafting the stories, I wanted to lift up their extraordinariness, their bravery, their compassion, but also really focus on their ordinariness, that these young people have done some really cool, interesting things, but they're not superheroes. These are all things that we can do, and they are both exemplars, but also very, and they would be the first to say this, very flawed human leaders.
In some respects, the perfect embodiment of what you were just talking about is the story you tell around Commitment 7, which is Keep Trying, the subtitle of that. I will own my mistakes and learn from them. I will apologize for the hurt I cause and learn how to be a more caring person. I will remind myself and everyone around me that we don't have to be perfect. We just have to keep trying to do what is right and just. I really like the way you say that. Tell our listeners about the story of Mary Pat and the frustrations that were a part of the important work that she was trying to do in her own community.
Mary Pat is a young woman who was growing up just outside of Atlanta, and one of the observations she made to me in her interview was that as a 15-year-old, she had been to more funerals and graduations. That gun violence was a regular part of her life and a regular part of so many people's lives. And her idea was to take those same tools that we use to dissuade young people and adults from smoking cigarettes or using drugs, these shock ads, and apply it to gun violence. And her issue is, and she'd be the first to say, it isn't guns per se. It's the fact that guns are used to hurt and harm other people. And so she had this idea to create these public service announcements, these billboards that would get young people to think twice before picking up a gun. And she was really clear that she wanted to lift this up out of the sense that the gun violence is a problem just in the Black community or poor communities, but and we see this increasingly with these mass shootings and suicides, that gun violence is something that affects all of us. And so she had this idea and went to get help from advertising agencies, from billboard companies, from philanthropists, And again, the answer was no. You're too young. This won't work. It doesn't make sense. We ended up giving her a large grant to get this off the ground. And even then, the same billboards that put up advertising for strip clubs, with scantily clad women in suggestive poses, wouldn't okay many of her images because they were too risque. These kind of messages around gun violence. But she got her billboards up, and she did it for a summer. And the police did this interesting study of her work, where they've got different districts, and the district where she put her billboards up had dramatic reductions in gun violence that summer. In the other districts, did not. Like, this great proof point of the effectiveness of what she's doing. And still, when she ran out of money, they took the billboards down, and back up went the pawn shops and the strip clubs. And she couldn't get anyone else to invest and believe in this idea. And one of the reasons I wanted to tell her story is, the way that we tell history is in reverse. So, of course Dr. King was going to lead the march in Selma. Of course the Montgomery bus boycott was going to be a success. But in the moment, none of those things were true. There's fear, there's confusion, there are mistakes. And so I wanted young people to know that that's part of their journey as well. The fact that they will make mistakes. We will make mistakes. There'll be confusions. There'll be failures. And that's an important part of the journey. And the commitment is to keep trying. The commitment is to get back up again and try something different.
Hmm. And I appreciate that one of the other commitments, as you are talking about what people should be kind of thinking about and attempting, that the whole matter of courage, of being courageous, can look different to different people. I mean, we sometimes think of when somebody has courage or is courageous, it means this. And courage can take a lot of different forms. And even someone who is a very sort of shy, gentle, retiring kind of person can be just as courageous as kind of the larger-than-life figures in our life that we might more immediately and easily think of as being figures of courage and confidence and so on. I think it's a terrific idea to get not just young people, but all of us thinking in broader terms about the ways in which this can happen and the kinds of people who can be part of it.
I think that's exactly right. And some of this is connected to how we, think about power and privilege and what we tend to focus on. For me, courage is not about not being afraid, but it's what you do with that fear. And so what I want to encourage young people and really all of us to do is to think about risk. So many of us, when we encounter a situation, whatever it is, we tend to start with, what do I get out of it? We tend to locate ourselves around our own needs. Then most of us will move to a place where we ask, what can I give? Right? We move to a place of generosity. But rarely do we make that next step and ask, what am I willing to give up? To talk about sacrifice. As I think about our country right now, I am most worried about that. This lack of investment in our public good. So we pull our kids out of the public school systems. We get fast track cards at Disney World, so we don't need to wait in the line. There are private highways that are being built in California. That's sort of removing ourselves from the public space and the commitment to that public space. And so what I wanted young people to think about is not just like what they can give, but what are they willing to give up? And to me, that's what courage is. It's that risk taking. And so for one young person, it might be speaking up when they're terrified. It might be trying something new that they've never done before, where failure is likely. Or it might be sitting down and creating space for other people. So risk looks different for different people in different moments. But it's got to be part of our equation as we're looking to create the beloved community.
Absolutely. I want to say that your book goes on to spell out six steps for imagining and implementing a peacemaking project, where you choose a particular injustice or problem that you care about. You need to understand it, really look at what is the root cause of the problem. Imagine how you might solve it, or how that problem might be solved. Plan something, a solution, into concrete steps. Act, and keep acting when you hit bumps in the road, and then reflect as you are working and as the project completes, just thinking about the way it has happened and what you did and what the consequences were. I mean, I really think that's important, because as you alluded to earlier in the book, it's very easy to think about all of this in very nebulous terms. And clearly that's one thing you really want to avoid. You want people not only to have these compassionate, concerned thoughts about their community, but you want them to act on them, and you want this book to be a guide to help make that possible.
That's right. You know, to me, peacemaking has got to be embodied. You know, it's not enough to want things to happen, but you have to make things happen. And what I wanted to give to young people was a step-by-step guide on how to do it. You know, so some young people know exactly what issues they want to tackle, others don't. Some young people know how to run and facilitate a meeting, others don't. And so this book is really a how-to guide, step-by-step workbook on how you create a peacemaking project. And it's supported by our digital platform at peacefirst.org that has the same tools to help young people create projects that have impact.
And I have to say that as inspiring as this book will surely be for young people, who are the readers for whom it is primarily designed and directed, that in fact anybody has a lot to learn from your book, and I'm sure you would agree.
That's my hope. You know, there's been a lot of, I think, interest in student organizing after the shootings in Parkland, Florida. And a lot of us, myself included, have been really inspired by the way young people have committed to taking action. And there's been this interesting narrative that on the surface sounds really positive, but I think if you dig deeper, it's problematic. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, young people get us out of this mess. Young people will figure this out. We need to let young people lead the way. And, you know, I've been talking to some young people in that particular movement. You know, what I'm hearing from them is, like, you all have a role in this, too. Like, we will play our part, but you have a role to play in this, too. And in each one of these seven stories, adults played a really important role. You know, sometimes, you know, I don't want to use this language, but sometimes there's a villain, they're sort of standing in the way, but also really enabling. All these young people talk about a caring adult who took them seriously. All of these young people talk about an adult who helped them think about their impact and drive change. Like there's a central role we all need to play. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that adults pick up this book and not only get inspired by the stories, but think about how they can build and model these practices themselves.
The book again is Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World, published by Viking. The author, Eric David Dawson. Eric David Dawson, thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Monday on The Morning Show from the archives, in honor of the Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions that is underway right now, we'll rebroadcast a fun interview with a past Jeopardy! Champion, Bob Harris. His book is called Prisoner of Trebekistan, A Decade in Jeopardy. That will be on Monday. On Tuesday, I'll be sharing my interview with Michael Shulman and his book, Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. Not exactly a biography of Meryl Streep, but it comes close. A wonderfully detailed and illuminating portrait of perhaps the greatest actor of our time. And on Wednesday's morning show, Anthony Rudell, author of Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio, a thorough look back at the earliest days of radio, a new technology that utterly changed our country and the world. Our weather forecast today, cloudy, windy, and cold. Morning flurries, high of 28 degrees. Cloudy and windy tonight, low down to 16. Cloudy, windy, cold once again tomorrow with a high of 25 degrees. We do finally have sunshine in the forecast on Sunday with a high of 33, warming to the low to mid 40s under sunny skies early next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical News.